Okay, we got up to slide 7. And here we're looking at a capillary bed, same capillary bed in A and B, just in different situations. But notice there's extensive branching to make for quite a few capillaries that makes up the overall bed. But that capillary bed is fed by an arteriole, as you would expect, right? The smallest of the arteries. And it's drained by a venule, the smallest of the veins. Notice, though, that there is a straight shot, a tube that goes directly from the arteriole to the venule, which we call a thoroughfare channel. And a thoroughfare channel is a way for blood to bypass the capillary bed. Now, it's only going to bypass the capillary bed if those tiny circular muscles that you see wrapped around the branches off of the thoroughfare channel, the capillaries themselves, in other words, if all of those are constricting, then that's going to basically close all of the capillary branches. And blood is just going to flow wherever there's least resistance, right? If all of those are closed, blood's just going to go directly to the venule. And therefore, that capillary bed will not receive any flow of blood. This can't happen forever, of course, right? Because if you keep the capillary bed closed down continuously, then whatever mass of cells that capillary bed serves will eventually die. The point here, though, is that we don't have nearly enough blood to pump blood to all tissues at the same time. And so most tissues in the body are actually, at any given moment, not receiving blood flow. But which ones are receiving blood flow and which ones aren't is continuously changing. Now, there's changes that occur because things are being used and other things are not being used. But even within a tissue that's being used, part of it is receiving flow through some channels and part of it is being cut off at that moment, and it just goes back and forth so that we can maintain blood pressure high enough for tissues to receive blood. If we were to open up all of the vessels, in other words, if we caused vasodilation globally in the body, then that too little amount of blood would basically stop flowing because you're trying to serve too many pipes at once. This is analogous to everyone in the city flushing the toilet at exactly the same time, right? There's not going to be enough water for all of those toilets at once. Only if you turn some on while others are off will things go smoothly. What would we call that, by the way, if you had vasodilation everywhere in the body at once? Yeah, that's shock. That leads to shock, and which can kill you. Right? By the way, speaking of flow, there's a difference between blood flow and blood perfusion. They're both measurements, but they refer to different measurements. So you don't use them interchangeably. Flow just refers to the rate at which blood flows to a given structure. So, as a rate, it's going to be, you know, typically milliliters per minute, or some volume per time. All right? Perfusion, on the other hand, is mass-specific flow. So it's volume of blood in a given amount of time per mass of that type of tissue. And so the perfusion really depends on how vascularized the tissue is. there are some tissues that are much more highly vascularized than other tissues. For instance, when we were looking at the thyroid gland, I mentioned that it was highly vascularized. Therefore, it has a pretty high perfusion. Perfusion can be higher than in one or small organ than it is in a big organ, even though the big organ is going to have a higher flow, simply because there's more of that stuff. But when you divide by a gram of that stuff, whichever one is more richly vascularized is going to have the higher perfusion. That's the difference. Okay, so any given capillary bed is either turned on or turned off at any given moment. And this is what's changing moment to moment to keep your blood pressure manageable. The little rings of muscles that control this in this picture are examples of sphincters. And since they are sphincters that happen right at the beginning of the capillary, they're called precapillary sphincters, as you see labeled here. Okay, let's go on to 8. Look at this pie chart. Here we're examining distribution of the blood. So how much blood is in the given container types at any given moment? And notice the vast inequity here. Most of your blood at any given moment is in your veins. 64% is just an average, but well over half of your blood is in your veins. It's not equally distributed among veins, arteries, and capillaries. Very little is in the capillaries at any given moment, mostly because even though there's a hell of a lot of capillaries, they're tiny in diameter, and they're not long either. So if you think of them as individual little containers, they're not much. Even when you add them all together, even though it's a hell of a big number of individual capillaries, their overall volume is not that much because they're not very long tubes. Why is it, though, that the difference between veins' capacity and arteries' capacity is so different? Is so big, I mean. Why are the veins holding a lot more blood than the arteries? When, you know, there are large arteries, medium arteries, small arteries, same for veins. So you would kind of expect for that veins to have just about as much volume as the arteries are holding at any given moment. What is it about veins that's different that allows them to take up this greater amount of volume? Or it allows them to hold this greater amount of volume.
Sorry.
What's the adjective that describes veins that allows them to open up like these pool emptying hoses I was talking about? They're compliant. They have high compliance, which means they can open up in response to blood flowing through them. They open up pretty widely. They stretch very easily and therefore don't resist that blood entering them very much, whereas the arteries do much more. So your veins are holding most of the blood at any given moment. That's the major point of this. Also notice that the systemic circuit, as you would expect, is holding most of the blood by far. The pulmonary circuit is not nearly as big a circuit in terms of plumbing, not nearly as many arteries, veins, and capillaries in the pulmonary circuit as the systemic, which is exactly why the right side of the heart doesn't have to be as strong as the left side of the heart, as we've already talked about. Okay. Let's go to 9 then and talk about how this plumbing is arranged. The normal situation, by far, most places in the body feature what's happening at the top part of this diagram. In other words, you have arteries that feed a capillary bed that then drain into veins, and you're back to the heart. So the normal situation is to have heart, arteries, capillaries, veins, and then you're back to the heart again. Vast majority of capillaries are like this, capillary beds. But remember, I said there are some exceptions to that where you have two capillary beds in series before you get back to the heart. And these, by definition, are the portal systems. How many portal systems are in your body? Well, you know about some at least, right? Which one did we talk about? What's the full name of it? Well, what are the two things that it connects? Right. Which is, what's another name for the pituitary gland?
Hypophysis.
What's the other end?
Hypothalamus.
So it's the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system. That's one portal system in the body. And just reappreciate right now why that's a portal system. Okay? You have arteries that go to the brain. Those then branch into one capillary bed that's surrounding the cells of the hypothalamus. That's where the hypothalamic hormones are put into the bloodstream. Those then collect into venules, which travel down through the infundibulum. And then, instead of taking it back to the heart, the venules branch into another capillary bed that surrounds the cells, the endocrine cells that make up the hypothalamus. The anterior pituitary. Right? So that's why it's a portal system. Two capillary beds in series, one after another, before you get back to the heart. So that's one of them. I haven't gotten a definitive answer as to how many portal systems there are in the body yet. I'll give you a hint. It's an integer. No one has any idea? It's three. So there's also a renal portal system, which we'll talk about when we talk about kidneys later. And the third one is the hepatic portal system, which, as the name implies, involves the liver. Those are the three. So portal systems are rare. Usually you have just one capillary bed before you get back to the heart. There are also, though, anastomoses, and that's a plural word. The singular is anastomosis. An anastomosis involves a branching and a convergence that is a little bit unusual. No, there's different kinds of anastomoses. Notice all three of these are anastomoses. A C, D, and E are all anastomoses. One common type is what's usually just called a shunt rather than calling it an arteriovenous anastomosis, although that's the official name for it. It's a shunt because this provides a bypass around a capillary bed, just like a highway bypasses a major city, if you take the loop. So blood can be sent to the capillary bed or it can go around it, depending on what's happening vasoconstriction-wise on the two arteries that feed these two pathways, either the capillary or the shunt. So it's called arteriovenous because it's directly from artery to vein. There are also venous anastomoses, which, notice, involve branching, which is unusual for a vein, and then reconverging of those veins. Usually, in the normal situation for veins is that they only converge, right? They don't branch also. So here you have a branching and then a reconvergence. And what that means as far as how they work is concerned is that you have multiple different pathways for blood that's draining from the capillary beds to get back to the heart. So if one path is blocked because something's pressing on your body, for instance, or for whatever reason, blood can still make it through the other route. So alternative routes for return of blood to the heart. You have exactly the same thing happening with arteries, though. In an arterial anastomosis, there are multiple pathways for blood to get to the capillary bed to begin with. Perfect example of this is the circle of Willis that's in the brain. Your brain is served partly by two carotid arteries, the internal carotid arteries where I was talking about those earlier when we were talking about carotid bodies, right? Those carotid arteries are really important because you want your blood to get brain. You want your brain to get blood. Well, if one of them is shut down for whatever reason, it can still flow through this circle called the circle of Willis in the brain. That's an example of an arterial anastomosis. So you can remain alive at least for a few more days. So those are the major possibilities. But, like I said, most of them are just the simple pathway. One capillary bed, arteries branch. Capillary bed is interposed between the arteries and the veins, and the veins converge rather than branch to get it back to the heart. All right, now to 10. Notice what's being graphed here. Systemic blood pressure in terms of units of millimeters of mercury. So this is a manometric graph. A manometer is a pressure reading device. And there are two lines here, two green lines, two curves. One that represents systolic pressure, one for diastolic pressure. On the x-axis, though, notice that you're measuring these at different places within the circuit, within the systemic circuit. Starting right as soon as it leaves the heart at the aorta, and then going through the path that blood takes all the way back to the heart. Capillaries in the middle, but then you drain the body and get the blood back to the heart through the veins, bigger and bigger veins. And there's a couple of things that are jump out from this. One, notice that diastolic and systolic pressure are different pressures for the vessels up until the capillaries. So for all the arteries, and what are the three major categories of arteries? What come first? Large arteries, okay, that's one. That's one of its names. What are the other two names? Elastic arteries, or what else? Conducting arteries, yeah. Those are the first ones, including the aorta. They are experiencing a higher systolic pressure than any other, which makes sense because they're closest to the heart, which is actually exerting the force that you measure as pressure when you divide that force by the area, right? That's the difference, by the way, between force and pressure. Keep that in mind. Pressure is force per area. So anyway, it makes sense that the aorta would experience the highest systolic pressure. When is that occurring? What does systolic mean? Of what? Right, in this case, the left ventricle. Systolic here, since we're looking at the systemic circuit, that means specifically that's when the left ventricle of the heart is contracting. That is the force. It pushes on the blood, which then pushes on all the walls of the container. Well, that nearest container is the aorta. And these things, as I said before, are called elastic arteries because they're able to take that pressure by expanding. Well, the farther you get away from the heart, the lower the pressure gets. This is just true in general for tubes that are flexible. The longer away you get from the pump, the smaller the pressure is going to be. If they were all rigid tubes, that wouldn't be true, but it's good that we don't have rigid tubes, because then the smallest vessels would be truly damaged by the high pressure during systole. All right? So a major job of the conducting arteries, besides getting blood to the next bigger arteries, is to take up that huge pressure so that the arteries after that aren't experiencing such a high systolic pressure. Well, the diastolic pressure is when the ventricle is contracting, of course. And the pressure at any given moment in that vessel is somewhere between diastolic and systolic, right? So the red squiggle here is the actual instantaneous pressure at any given second or fraction of a second. It's going up and down each beat of the heart between diastolic and systolic. It doesn't get higher than systolic, it doesn't get lower than diastolic, but it's always somewhere in between. And so a third one that we give the name pressure, but it's actually a pressure difference, is what we call pulse pressure. The pulse pressure is the difference between systolic pressure and diastolic pressure. So in this figure, it's the height of the red, it's the amplitude of the red wave, or just the difference between the two green lines. That's the pulse pressure. So the elastic arteries experience the greatest pulse pressure. And this is what would be damaging to smaller tubes. They would also, if you had a rigid aorta, they would also be experiencing a high pulse pressure. But because of the elasticity of the conducting arteries, that pulse pressure gets reduced the farther away you get from the heart. And that keeps those smaller arteries from damaging themselves. All right? Notice that the pulse pressure becomes zero when you get to the capillaries. That does not mean you don't have blood pressure at the capillaries. I said the pulse pressure is zero, but remember, the pulse pressure is a delta pressure, really. It's a difference. So it simply means that at the capillaries, there is no difference when the ventricle is contracting versus when it's relaxing. The pressure is the same in the capillaries at that point because the pulse pressure has become zero. The blood pressure, though, is still positive, of course. Now, this has important implications as well. This makes the fact that arteries have a positive pulse pressure, meaning that their pressure changes throughout the heartbeat from each cycle, that means the flow of blood through the arteries is pulsatile, which is exactly why if you put a nick in an artery, you're going to have squirts, right? One per heartbeat. Whereas if you put a nick in a vein, it just seeps. There's no beating of the heart that's recognizable in the leakage from a vein. And that's because the vein, anything from capillary onward, still has a zero pulse pressure, which is why it's all converged just to one single red line here at that point. Well, this is important, though, for capillaries. Because if capillaries were pulsatile, you would have red blood cells being moved quickly through them and then slowing down and then quickly moving again. It's much more efficient for gas exchange if they're never moving quickly, but just moving steadily through there. So there can be a diffusion of oxygen either into the blood or out of the blood, depending on which circuit you're in. And the same thing for carbon dioxide, but only in the opposite direction. Okay, then the overall pressure, though, drops continuously until you get back to the heart. The only reason you have this little squiggle at the end, where the pressure goes up and down a little bit in the vena cava, is that these are large veins emptying directly into the heart, which is surrounded by the lungs, And when you breathe, those lungs push on the vessels themselves. So the just ventilation is causing a little bit of pumping of these, the squeezing of these vena cavae. That's the only reason the pressure is going up. It's not because of what's happening at the heart. Notice that it's effectively zero pressure by the time it finally dumps into the right atrium. Yeah.
So, does the mean arterial pressure have more of an influence in risk disorders, does it?
Yeah, the mean arterial pressure, first of all, is to actually quantify that, you would have to take many, many measurements of arterial pressure at the moment and add them all together and then divide by the number of measurements you took in that over that course of the one cycle. So it's not simply the systolic plus the diastolic divided by 2, because the amount of time spent in systole is different from the amount of time spent in diastole, and therefore they're weighted differently. But if you took a true mean of all the pressures you measure throughout one cardiac cycle, that would be the mean arterial pressure. And that is what is important not only for the normal functioning of the blood and the vessels, but yes, that's what can be problematic when it comes to disorders that are pressure related. The mean arterial pressure, though, for anything capillary and beyond, is simply the only pressure that it has, right? Because there is no pulse pressure there. So if you take an instantaneous measure of the pressure in the capillary, that's the same as the mean arterial pressure because it doesn't go up and down. Okay. Now let's talk more about flow. This is slide 11. Blood is liquid, of course, and when you have liquid flowing through tubes, there is a certain amount of resistance of the flow through the tubes. That's one factor that affects flow of liquid through a tube. If you think of our heart being the source of the force behind the pressure, how hard the heart works must matter, of course, right, to the amount of flow. Well, flow overall is proportional to, which is what that symbol means, the pressure, or the pressure differential from one end of the tube to the next, or one end of a section of the tube to the other. That's the pressure differential, or gradient, I mean, divided by the resistance. So when you write it like this, hopefully it makes mathematical sense to you that if resistance is high, you're not going to have very much flow, right? Because you're dividing by a big number. You're going to get a small answer. On the other hand, if there is a big gradient of pressure from A to B, one end of the tube to the other, then you're going to get a high flow, right? So the bigger the pressure difference, the greater the flow. The bigger the resistance, the smaller the flow. This is, by the way, exactly analogous to Ohm's law, right? Which is V equals IR for electricity. Well, V is voltage, which is really just another gradient. A voltage is a gradient of electrical potential energy. So it's the same as delta P. If we solved this for I, it would be I equals V over R. I is current, electrical current, which is the flow of electrons. V, the voltage, is the electrical potential difference, the gradient. Here it's pressure gradient rather than electrical potential. And R is resistance in both cases. All right, so they're totally analogous. Anyway, as far as the anatomy of the body is concerned, or the cardiovascular system, the amount of flow can be affected by three things. One is the length of the tubing. And the longer the tube is, the more resistance you have. Now you can prove that to yourself by trying to breathe through a short straw and trying to breathe through a straw of the same diameter but that's twice as long. You'll see that it's harder to get the air through that longer tube. Second thing that matters is the amount of liquid that you have in this in the set of tubes, which in the case of the body would be the amount of blood. The blood volume matters. And then the third is the diameter of the tubing. So all three of those things would affect flow. Pressure and flow are related, right? So if one of these things affects pressure, it affects flow. But think about these three things: amount of blood, length of the tubes, and the diameter of the tubes. Yes, they all three can change to a certain degree, but moment to moment, you're not greatly affecting the amount of blood that's in your body. You do over longer term, right? That's a major function of your kidneys, is to adjust the amount of blood that you have, because your kidneys are going to determine how much of the stuff that's filtered from blood gets put back in or how much is left out and stays as urine. So whatever doesn't get put back in, whatever does get put back in, that's the amount of blood that you have. The kidneys are the most important thing in adjusting the amount of blood. But that doesn't happen second to second. Right? That's a longer term effect. Also, yeah, blood vessels can grow, but moment to moment, the length of this tubing is not really changing, right? Which means the only thing that the body can do to quickly change any of these three things is to adjust the diameter of the tubing. And that's what vasomotion is. Vasomotion is the general term that encompasses both vasoconstriction and vasodilation. In other words, there's two major kinds of vasomotion. Not only is this the easiest thing to adjust on the short term, second to second that is, but it has a huge effect on resistance. And therefore, because of this relationship, it has a huge effect on flow. If you change resistance, you change flow. Right? You increase resistance, you're going to decrease flow. If you decrease resistance, you're going to increase flow. So that's how we make moment-to-moment adjustments. Not by making the tube shorter or longer, not by changing significantly the amount of blood from 1 second to the next, but by changing the diameter. Now the diameter, or the, strictly speaking, the radius, but radius is just half of the diameter. The resistance of flow through a tube is proportional to the radius to the fourth power. This is why this has such a drastic effect. So what that means is if you vasodilate, you first are at some radius. Doesn't matter what the radius is, just for simplicity, if we call it a radius of 1 originally. If you vasodilate so that you double the radius, which of course would also double the diameter, right? But you now have a radius of 2. How much is that going to change the resistance? Well, what is 2 to the 4th? 1 to the 4th is easy, right? That's 1. 2 to the 4th is what? 16. So that means you now all of a sudden in that vasodilated tube have only 1/16 of the resistance that you had before. Which means, assuming the blood pressure is the same, the only thing changing here is the radius, I mean the resistance, that means you're going to have 16 times the flow just by that little dilation. And a doubling of the radius is not extraordinary. If you tripled it, which is, you could actually do it 4 times as big. Vessels that vasoconstrict or vasodilate have that much of a ability to change their radius. But what if you tripled it? 3 to the 4th, in other words, is what? 81. 81 times the flow by just vasodilating so that it goes from a radius of 1 to a radius of 3, or a radius of whatever to a radius of 3 times that. That's an extraordinary amount of flow difference that you can cause simply by either contracting or relaxing the smooth muscle in what part of the vessel? In terms of the coverings of the vessel. Where's the smooth muscle? Which tunic? Right, in the tunica media. So that's why we do it this way. We can't really adjust the amount of blood second to second or the length of the tubing. So we mess around with the diameter and or the radius. And slide 12 shows you that effect here. This is it's not actually a before and after. These are two sections of the same exact artery, just right next to each other, though. One is upstream and one's downstream, just a little bit farther down line. But on this one, well, it was all open this amount at first, and then they treated this downstream portion just with a tiny amount of epinephrine, and it drastically, the radius is only about 1/4, so that would be an 81-fold decrease in flow. So this is one way, this vasomotion is how we control flow, but there are 3 major ways that we can have vasomotion come about. One of which is local control. There's local control meaning that it's only affecting that capillary bed, not over the whole body at once. And local control is mainly due to what we call autoregulation. So autoregulation refers to the fact that when the various metabolites or waste products build up in a tissue, those metabolites actually cause relaxation of smooth muscle in precapillary sphincters, like the ones we were looking at in the first slide today. Those precapillary sphincters, when they relax, they're no longer keeping blood out, and the blood pressure will just open up the ring. It's not that muscles are actively dilating a vessel, it's just that they relax, and then the blood pressure is able to open up the tube. Okay? So, but that happens in response to low O2, high CO2, and high other metabolites as well. Things that build up when the blood is not carrying away the waste products fast enough. Right? The cells are undergoing cellular respiration. So they're decreasing the O2, they're using it for the respiration. They're also building up the CO2, and that's what actually directly causes the muscles to relax. That's going to automatically bring blood to just that tissue that requires it. So that's autoregulation, which is an example of local control. There's also 2 types of more global control, though. There's neural control, and there's hormonal control. And you should already know the difference between that, right? The nervous system is sending signals to vessels via neurotransmitters, which can cause vasomotion, but you also can have various kinds of hormones, some of which we've talked about already in a different chapter, right? Like aldosterone, for instance, affects blood pressure, so does angiotensin. And we've already talked about them a little bit, but we'll talk about those in a different chapter once again. Anyway, those are more global because, well, endocrine especially, right? Because endocrine control, those are broadcast throughout the body. Nervous control can be either global or local depending on what the nervous system is doing, right? You can send out nervous signals to the whole body, or you can send them to just one organ. Local control is by definition local. And by the way, in addition to autoregulation, local control involves some paracrine signals. Remember the difference between a paracrine and an endocrine signal? What is it? Right. Paracrine signals don't make it into the bloodstream. They're just released by cells and they operate just in that local area in the interstitial fluid. So this is another way for local control to happen. Okay. Now to 13, blood velocity in the systemic circuit. How quickly the flow is happening at various parts in the body. And when you look at the velocity column, notice also this one's ordered anatomically, starting at the heart, going through the aorta, arteries first, then capillaries, then small veins, and then big veins back to the heart. But when you look at the velocity column, unlike the pressure, which just continuously got lower and lower until you were all the way back to the heart, the speed of blood flow starts out high, drops, and is lowest in the capillaries, and then speeds up again, even though the pressure keeps dropping throughout these tubes. Now, this is another important thing about capillaries. Capillaries wouldn't do as efficient a job if they were pulsatile, meaning if they had a positive pulse pressure, which they don't. They also wouldn't operate very well if you shot blood through there very quickly, right? Just wouldn't even give time for diffusion to happen. So the best situation is to flow blood through the capillaries steadily and slowly, so that while they're in that short distance of capillary tube, there's still plenty of time for oxygen to diffuse one way and carbon dioxide to diffuse another way. All right, but why biophysically does this happen? Why is blood flow slowest in the capillaries? Well, you should think about this by analogy with a river. If you think of a river, you know, there are different parts of it that are narrow. Some parts are wide. And, I mean, unless you're at drastically different sizes of river, if a river goes from wide to narrow, it's not changing the amount of water, right? So that narrowing part, you have to get that same amount of water through a smaller space in the same amount of time, which means when you have a narrowing in the river, you have a faster speed. The water flows swiftly through a narrow, right? When you get to a big place where it's wide open, it seems like the river's not even flowing it because it's so slow. It is flowing, it's just more slowly through that wide part. And that's simply because there's more volume available for that water the wider it is. Now, this seems opposite to what I just told you about the vessels, because the capillaries, you know, are the smallest, by far, diameter tubes. Okay? But there's a shitload of them. So you mean you have one aorta, right? It has a measurable diameter. And that's carrying all the blood in the circuit. At that moment that it's in the aorta. All of that blood goes through the aorta. Then it branches into smaller and smaller arteries, yes, they're individually smaller diameter, and same is true especially for the capillaries. But if you were to take all of those capillaries and put them side by side, like little straws in a box, and then measure the total cross-sectional area by adding up all the individual tubes' areas, then that would be a much bigger area than the size of the aorta. So the capillaries are like a very wide part of the river, since there's so many of them. And so that blood going through the capillaries has a lot more room to spread out, basically, if you think about all the capillaries combined. And therefore, it goes much more slowly through the capillaries. Well, on the way back, even though the pressure is still dropping, on the way back, you're now forcing that same amount of blood through fewer and fewer veins, and the total cross-sectional area of the veins is much less than the total cross-sectional area of the capillaries. So it's like the river is narrowing again, and therefore the flow is speeding up. All right, that explains why you have a dip and then a rise again in flow, whereas all you have pressure-wise is a steady drop. Well, that's probably a good place to stop. Well, let me add one thing before I turn off the recorder. When I was talking about the vasomotion affecting the resistance, I didn't really explain why there is such a sensitivity of flow to, such a sensitivity of resistance to the diameter. If you think about liquid flowing through the tube, you have what is called laminar flow. Laminar is just the adjective of lamina, which means layer. So you have a layered flow. And in a circular cross-section tube, like an artery, like what I'm referring to is the picture in slide 11, what you really have are a bunch of concentric cylinders of blood. Smaller and smaller cylinders as you go to the center of the artery or vessel, not just arteries. Anyway, that central cylinder of blood is the farthest away from the walls, which are stationary, so that it experiences the least friction. Whereas the blood that's right against the vessel wall, it's scraping against something that's not moving along with the blood. And so there's a lot of friction right there at the wall. The short arrow here refers to not as great a flow because of greater frictional resistance. Well, that's going to slow down that outer cylinder of blood. And therefore, the next inner cylinder is going to be slowed down a little bit by that blood, but not as much as it would be slowed down by a totally stationary wall. And as you get closer and closer to the center of the tube, that blood is moving with least resistance and therefore travels with much greater flow. Well, if you open up the diameter, you're causing a greater percentage of that blood to be away from the walls and therefore to be experiencing little friction, and that increases the flow. Forgot to mention it while we were on the slide, but let's end there.